from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said yesterday that the Fed will start winding down monetary stimulus later this year if employment numbers continue to improve. Bernanke said the economy is expanding at a moderate rate and risks to the recovery have diminished since last fall. But experts disagree about how optimistic we should be about the economy. UCLA's June forecast says that despite improvement, the U.S. economy is not in recovery. Forum takes stock of the national and state economies after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Federal Reserve Bank Chair Ben Bernanke spoke yesterday about monetary policy, and he indicated that he believed the economy was growing enough that the central bank intends this year to reduce its bond buying. Other economic forecasters feel economic recovery is still out of reach, and the real question before us is, are we in a recovery, or does it just seem that way? This morning's opening hour, we want to focus on the economy, and let me tell you who is joining us for that. I want to welcome, first of all, Peter Coy, economics editor with Bloomberg Businessweek, who joins us this morning from New York, and we welcome you back, Peter Coy. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to being on.
Glad to have you on. And Jerry Nicholsberg is also with us this morning, adjunct professor of economics at UCLA's Anderson School of Management and senior economist with UCLA's Anderson Forecast. Welcome back, Jerry Nicholsberg.
Thank you. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. We also want to welcome back Christopher Thornburg, who is founding partner of Beacon Economics. And Beacon Economics is an independent economic research and consulting firm. They are located in Los Angeles. And Christopher Thornburg joins us from Malibu. Good morning, Christopher Thornburg.
Actually, I'm in Los Angeles. It's Jerry who's in Malibu.
I'm sorry. You are in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I'm not
Jerry.
Quite that fancy yet.
All right. We've already got class distinctions here, and sorry about that. Actually, let me begin, if I may, Peter Coy, with you. When I presume Chairman Bernanke talks, investors listen, and they were a bit surprised by what he had to say yesterday, taking a step down in the pace of purchases. And from your perspective, I guess it suggests that he's pretty optimistic about the economy, obviously. He's saying if the economy is sustained, but maybe rushing in a little too headlong?
Well, he surprised me because after the last statement when bond yields backed up, I thought he was going to sort of step back from that talk a little bit and make it clear that the Fed was not ready to withdraw any of its stimulus. But he went ahead and said that they plan to start well, this could change, but they plan to start reducing the pace of bond purchases later this year and end it entirely by mid-2014, at which point they're expecting that the unemployment rate will be down around 7%, which is still well above its target. What he tried to do was make it clear that that's not the equivalent of putting on the brakes. It's more the equivalent of letting up a bit on the accelerator pedal. So they'll still be providing stimulus in the form of bond buying, which helps lower long-term interest rates. And even after they end that, they'll still be keeping the short-term rates low because they control the federal funds rate, which is overnight lending between banks. But to answer your question, I was a bit surprised that they're going ahead with this, even though Bernanke did make it clear that it's contingent on the incoming news. And if the incoming news really is bad, they can go on continuing to buy or possibly, although unlikely, even increasing their purchases.
Yeah, I was struck by this car metaphor that he was bringing before us, not stopping the brakes, but letting up a bit on the gas pedal. But does this muddy the message of interest rates being low until the economy is on its way to full recovery, which is essentially what he said before Congress?
Well, I think so. It's a subtle message he's trying to convey, and Wall Street doesn't like subtlety. they want a bottom line, something that they can bet on. The subtlety that he's trying to convey is, hey, there's a big difference between easing up on bond purchases and tightening monetary policy, and that we wouldn't even consider there would be a substantial interval of time between the ending of bond purchases and the beginning of withdrawing liquidity to push up short-term interest rates. But you see what happened. The market reacted badly, especially overnight abroad.
Went over to down over 200. And although some are saying this is not necessarily because of Chairman Bernanke's pronouncements yesterday, monetary policies, just to quote him or paraphrase what he said, not being triggers but a threshold, but maybe has more to do with China.
I think it does. But there's a link between the U.S. and China. A big reason for the global liquidity is the U.S. pumping out all this money. And it seems in some cases to have benefited foreign markets almost more than it has America. So when we start pulling our liquidity back, the world feels it.
And Peter Coy is economics editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, and Jerry Nicholsberg is an adjunct professor of economics at UCLA's Anderson School of Management, and he is in Malibu, senior economist with UCLA's Anderson Forecast. We're really not in sync here, at least as far as the Anderson Forecast, Jerry, with Bernanke. I mean, his growing confidence in the economy is almost in direct opposition to what you guys have been saying.
Well, you know, not really. We're both looking at the same data, and we're seeing an economy that is growing. And it's an economy that's growing at a below-average rate. So the point that we've been trying to make is that when you see employment numbers like 175,000 or 200,000 a month, that's not really time to cheer. We used to think that that was subpar, and indeed it is subpar. And if you look behind the numbers, basically the economy is growing fast enough to pick up the expansion in the labor force due to population growth, that the ratio of the number of people who are employed to the population has been constant. So we're just marking time in that sense. We're not really making progress. But, you know, if you buy Ben Bernanke's assumptions, then you come to the conclusion that he has. I would have liked to have seen him say that we are not just tapering off, but we're tapering off rapidly because there is another problem lurking out there, which is that the Federal Reserve's balance sheet has tripled, and moving back on the accelerator means that the balance sheet is still growing. And the Fed has a huge problem of how to get that liquidity out of the system. It's never been done before. It is, in the words of many of the members of the FOMC, uncharted territory, but they kind of believe they can do it. So I think there are real dangers in this policy, but for the moment, it's not going to make a lot of difference one way or the other.
Well, when I said you were at odds, I meant mainly on conclusions. Excuse me, from what I've read of the UCLA Anderson forecast, you've come to the conclusions that this growth rate not only is not strong enough for the recovery, but the UCLA report says there aren't enough good jobs, really, to build a strong middle class.
Well, I think that's correct. That if, you know, if you look at the slow recovery and kind of adjust it for people dropping out of the labor force, you have to ask, well, why aren't those people finding jobs as the economy is growing? And one of the reasons it seems to underlie it is that we are transforming from an industrial economy to what some people call post-industrial, others an information economy. And that kind of transformation historically takes about 7 years, and it's about 7 years of slow growth. So that you know, is the kind of thing that we think we're experiencing now, and stimulative monetary policy has historically never really worked in those circumstances to drive down the unemployment rate and give you growth rates that are greater than 3%, greater than average.
So when Chairman Bernanke predicts that growth will proceed at a moderate pace and unemployment rate will gradually decline, you're not in agreement?
Well, his moderate pace is about what we've got now, 2.5% to 3% to 3.5%. That's not enough to recover from the recession and add jobs for those who are entering the labor force due to population growth. It means that we're still substantially below potential GDP or trend GDP.
And California is consistent with these national trends?
Interestingly, California is not consistent with these national trends. In California, we are growing more rapidly than the U.S. In the last 12 months, so the 12 months ending in April, only one state had a higher employment growth rate than California, and that was Utah. Both California and Utah, driven by their tech sectors. California has consistently been in the top in terms of GDP growth. And the reason why California's unemployment rate is not below the U.S. unemployment rate right now is that, unlike in vast areas of the U.S., California doesn't have discouraged workers leaving the labor force. We have encouraged workers. We've added 600,000 Californians to the labor force. So California is actually growing, and relative to the U.S., doing quite well, California and a few other states.
Now, just to get back to Chairman Bernanke for a moment, if I could, with you, Jerry Nicholsberg, you are of the opinion that he moved too fast on this, and their continuing bond purchases is making future policy problem just worse.
That is correct, that that the Federal Reserve has an enormous amount of liquidity infused into the system, trying to manipulate long interest rates. And as Chairman Bernanke expressed in explaining this to Congress, the idea was to push up the stock market and to push up home prices, to make bonds less attractive and equities and houses more attractive, so that people would feel wealthier and then go out and spend more money, and that would boost consumption. If you look at the data, it really hasn't boosted consumption like that, because people remember that their 401ks used to be 101ks, and they could be again. So, you know, they're happy, but they're not increasing consumption and driving down their savings rates. So what is the problem with all this liquidity? You have to take it out of the system when the economy gets growing. If you don't, you get an inflation. If you take it out too fast, you get a recession. If you don't take it out fast enough, you get inflation, which you have to moderate with a recession. And so the Fed is really in uncharted waters, because no central bank has really successfully done this in the past.
But the bottom line is they're still printing too much money. And you mentioned inflation. What about the inflation rate? Usually Fed's trying to cool off high inflation. We're in a very different world now, aren't we?
Exactly. And so the FOMC, in looking at the inflation rate, says, you know, inflation is quite low, and so we have room to maneuver. And they are correct in that. But historically, when inflation expectations get built in, it's really slow to get an inflation hard to get an inflation going. But when it gets going and it gets built into people's expectations, it's really hard to stop it, as Chairman Volcker discovered in the early 80s.
Let me bring Christopher Thornburg into this, who's founding partner of Beacon Economics. Christopher Thornburg, on the brighter side, there is improvement in housing. I think every region in the country now finds housing prices are going up and household spending is going up. But today we saw quite a dip, as we mentioned, in stock markets. So how do things look from your crystal ball?
Yeah, well, a couple things. Look, the fact that this has been a lousy recovery is not news by any stretch of the imagination. I was sort of surprised that there was anybody really who found that surprising. We know this has been a lousy recovery. Be that as it may, you know, you have to stop focusing on where we were in 2006 and really think about where the economy is heading now. And it's obvious to me what Bernanke is responding to. If you look across the economy today, there's plenty of signs that suggests that the economy is actually doing better. Is it doing great? No, absolutely not. But then, given some of the headwinds from government spending, given some of the issues with the world economy, it's hardly a surprise. To Jerry's point, absolutely, we are definitely in the midst of a major social transition, and that also is taking its toll. But when you take a step back and put that to one side, realize that we're getting faster employment growth. We're seeing much better numbers in terms of income growth. We are seeing, of course, as you noted, a recovery in the housing market. And that's been a big hole in the economy over the past bunch of years. Construction activity is still substantially below long-term trends. And construction bouncing back at the pace it is will contribute a lot to economic growth over the course of the next couple of years, and that's very good for the economy. Rising home prices will take stress off the households across the nation as well, and that's relatively good news. You're already starting to see positive equity extraction from the housing market, which is great. Think how much better this would be if we could actually get people mortgages. There's still obviously a real credit crunch for folks in what I would call kind of the mid-credit tier. It's very hard for them to get a loan right now.
Actually, mortgage rates are up, I think, aren't they? I mean,
yeah,
just,
yeah,
as a result of Bernanke. I mean, they've just gone up as a result of
Well,
Bernanke.
Yeah, but you know, look, that was going to happen. And I don't think it's really as a result of Bernanke. I mean, a lot of this has – don't forget, interest rates have been rising modestly for the last couple months now, and they should. Ultimately, interest rates have been very low because every time we turn around, there's been some, you know, Chicken Little screaming – double dip, screaming the end is nigh, screaming, you know, we're way behind and things are terrible. And as a result of that, you've seen a lot of this economy continue to move in almost a recession-type way over the course of the last couple of years. You look at a lot of the financial ratios that we pay attention to at Beacon, and it's almost as if the U.S. economy is in a recession even though it's not. And a lot of risk aversion, a lot of people really being afraid, and that fear is starting to fade away. People are putting money out elsewhere, and as a result of that, if Ben Bernanke's looking down the road, he realizes that he really is going to have to start unwinding monetary policy, as was always going to happen. Again, where's the surprise here? We knew he couldn't continue to buy bonds forever. Now, mind you, I think that interest rates are low not because of Fed policy. A lot of economists have sort of weighed in on this, and then the standard view is maybe Fed policy has contributed 0.5%, maybe 0.33% off of sort of long-term rates. Rates are low today, mostly because the world is awash with capital relative to a diminished demand for capital, particularly with a recessionary Europe and an overall global economy that's struggling. That's a low interest rate environment, and that's not going to go away. Now, one of the reasons I think Bernanke's standing up and doing what he's doing is he understands that he has to start unwinding things over the course of the next couple of years. And every time he says anything, there's going to be this kind of crazy volatility. Markets are going to drop, interest rates are going to go up, and you're going to see all this kind of crazy up and down. But you know what? It's just that. It's just silly volatility. It's because of all these models they're using on Wall Street, which are keyed off of certain words, on microsecond trading. He knows this is going to be the response. Here's my prediction. Over the next 3-4 weeks, you're going to see the stock markets go back up to where they were. Interest rates won't go all the way back to where they were, but they'll cool off just again. What he has to do is almost train the market to be used to this, to hear this noise, so when he actually does start making moves, they're not going to be responding as violently. And I think what you're going to see is he's going to continue to get up over the course of the next few months and do the same thing. Look, it's coming. The end's coming. We have to start backing off on this. And every time that happens, there'll be less and less of this volatility because, again, the markets get a little bit used to it. It's a game he has to play. This psychology of the markets thing he has to do this.
No, I understand what you're saying about his being compelled to do this. But when you talk about the Chicken Littles in the market, for example, I'm struck by continuing to read about people like Warren Buffett and John Paulson and George Soros. All these billionaires are dumping their stocks because they're afraid, clearly, of a massive kind of market correction.
I can say firsthand that doing some work with some of those folks he just listed, I don't know any kind of massive dumping of equities. And in general, keep something in mind. There's no reason the world equities should have a correction. You have a situation where corporate profits are at record high levels and interest rates are at record low levels. That all would suggest, if you sit down and run some numbers, that would almost suggest the market continues to be undervalued, not overvalued, because ultimately the stock market reflects corporate profits and interest rates, not the broader health of the economy. So, you know, you may see people trying to time the market. Maybe they're expecting some sort of reaction, but, you know, what you want to do is you want to sell at the top, buy at the bottom. They may be doing that kind of short-term strategic market timing moves, but ultimately from a pure take a step back and look at where the market is today standpoint, the market actually a little bit undervalued relative to where it should be.
Christopher Thornburg with us from Los Angeles is a founding partner of Beacon Economics, which is an independent economic research and consulting firm. Excuse me. I'm going to take this opportunity to ask you, our listeners, to join in this conversation. Every opportunity to do that, then you can do that now by calling our toll-free number. If you have something you'd like to either ask or a comment you have to make, please feel free to call us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, and it's available to you now. Again, that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. 6786, and you can also join the conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum, or our Facebook page, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Just wondering, though, Peter Coy, if I can go back to you on this. There's a lot of talk about falling profit margins and shorter dividends up ahead. How does that all factor in?
Well, I want to go back to what to me was the most surprising thing yesterday. It wasn't that Bernanke said they were going to start reducing asset purchases, because as Chris pointed out, you know, he's got to start signaling that, and he had begun saying that in the congressional testimony. To me, the most surprising thing was the dissent from that decision by James Bullard. He's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, and Bullard calls himself the North Star of inflation hawks, and yet here he was dissenting by saying that the Fed was not signaling strongly enough that it was determined to get the inflation rate up. Because, of course, the Fed is historically known as being the inflation fighter, working to lower the inflation rate. Right now, inflation, as measured by the Fed's preferred indicator, is below the 2% target. So what he's kind of saying is, look, let's fair is fair. If we believe that inflation above target is wrong, then we should equally believe that inflation below target is wrong, and we should be just as assiduous about getting it to where we want it to be. As far as he was concerned, by talking about saying, well, you know, maybe we don't need to do as much in the future as we've been doing now, the Fed doesn't seem to be taking that 2% inflation target seriously enough.
So what are we to conclude from his response? I mean, in terms of the bigger picture.
So the implication of this is that the Fed. So there's been a debate for a while now. If the Fed backs off, is it because it's really optimistic about the condition of the economy, or I should say more optimistic? Or is it because it's lost faith in the effectiveness of asset purchases as a tool to affect the economy? Ben Bernanke was specifically asked that question at the press conference yesterday, and he said, no, we do believe that it's an effective tool. We just happen to think that it's not needed quite as much now. But I think that he didn't quite quell the concerns of those who think that the Fed is, to some degree, kind of giving up and saying, well, this is about the best we can get, and we'll just have to let the economy take its course.
Well, again, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said yesterday that the Fed will start winding down monetary stimulus later this year if employment numbers continue to improve. He said the economy is expanding at a moderate rate and risks to the recovery have diminished since last fall. But experts disagree about how optimistic we should be about this, and you may want to weigh in here on how optimistic you are. UCLA's June forecast says that despite improvement, the U.S. economy is not in recovery. And talking about the U.S. economy here this hour with Peter Coy, Christopher Thornburg, and Jerry Nicholsberg, and you. And again, we invite listeners to join us. You can call our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also join the conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page or email us. At forum@kqed.org. And of course, you can tweet us as well. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. When we come back, we'll hear from you, and you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the economy this hour with Jerry Nicholsberg, who is adjunct professor of economics at UCLA's Anderson School of Management and senior economist with UCLA's Anderson Forecast. And also Peter Coy is with us, economics editor for Bloomberg Business Week, and Christopher Thornburg, who is founding partner of Beacon Economics. We're going to go to your calls here forthwith. But Chris Thornburg, I didn't mean to put the kibosh on you. I think you had something else you wanted to add here.
Yeah, well, there's something about the Fed policy that I think we all have to keep in mind. You know, ultimately, and there's a lot of discussion about what it does or does not mean for inflation and the economy. And one of the things that has stymied his efforts is the fact that the vast majority of cash the Fed has pumped into the economy isn't in the economy. People aren't really recognizing that. Indeed, there's a lot of conversation about, you know, what this, how this money is sloshing around the system. Well, it is not. Well over 80%, something on the order of about 83% of all the money pumped into the economy from various sorts of Fed buying policies, is all that money is sitting in the banks in the form of excess reserves. And ultimately, what that means is if he continues to pump money into the economy, he's doing little more than inflating those excess reserves even farther and really not doing all that much. And, of course, every time you do this, he's just making the extraction problem that much larger and more complicated when it does come time to do that, as Jerry had alluded to earlier. So with that in mind, you know, it's not as if this program it has been as effective as people would imagine as a result of that situation. But it also means, by the way, that inflation is almost non-existent for the same reason, that the cash is simply not in the system and thus is not potential inflation at this point in time.
Jerry Nicholsberg, you want to add something here?
Well, I agree with what Chris said. The real issue is that the cash is sitting in banks. The program is not effective, but yet the Federal Reserve continues to go ahead with a program that's not effective, making the future job of the future chairman of the Federal Reserve and the other FOMC members more difficult. And the reason why it's more difficult is that these non-borrowed reserves that are sitting in the banks that are really not affecting economic activity, when the economy gets going and banks perceive that they have good credits that they want to lend to, they'll start lending that money out. And that's when the money goes into the economy, and the Federal Reserve has got to get that their balance sheet down by 70% during that period of time. It's a quite difficult task to do. It's never been done before. The other thing that comment that I'd like to make is on Peter's comment on President Ballard's saying that, well, we should be hitting the 2% target rate. It really surprises me that these folks don't look back at history. Central banks have never really been able to target an inflation rate, hit it, and hold it. That's just something that's not in the cards. And in all of economic history, as we study it, monetary policy in particular, we find that monetary policy is a really blunt instrument. It takes a long time to work and a long time to counteract. It's like a large freighter coming into one of California's ports. It's hard to stop it, hard to turn it. And so, you know, this is really a problem. And indeed, even the Federal Reserve, not in this FOMC meeting minutes, but in the previous one, said, well, monetary policy is a really blunt instrument. So why he thinks it can be used as a fine-tuning instrument is sort of beyond me.
Let me bring our callers into this discussion. We begin, Philip, with you. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi. It seems to me that analysts are drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, one of your guests said that he thought that stocks were undervalued, but yet the indexes are higher than they've ever been, given that we're, you know, in this balance sheet recession. My understanding is that if you remove the quantitative easing expansion of the money supply, that we've actually been in recession, that the only reason that, you know, we're growing at the 2% rate is because of the quantitative easing. And everybody should remember sequestration kicks in Q3, Q4. So, you know, wait for the storm. So I don't understand the optimism.
Chris Arnberg.
That's just completely wrong. But the economy has not been growing because of quantitative easing. I think we made that clear that, for the most part, quantitative easing has done very little except for increased excess reserves of banks. It hasn't had much of an impact. The economy is growing because consumer spending is growing. And in terms of the stock market, the reason the indices are at all-time high levels is because corporate profits are at all-time high levels, and interest rates are close to all-time low levels. And if you add that up, those are the two fundamentals that drive equity prices. You know, listen, I get it. Middle-class America isn't doing so well, but that's not true for corporate America. Corporate America is at the top of their game right now, and as a result of that, that stock market is very high.
And that's one of the things that makes middle-class America very nervous, to put it mildly, that they're at the top of their game while the suffering is sort of trickling down.
I'm completely cognizant of people's frustration on that front. I get it, but nevertheless, in a nation which is
hardly going to, shall we say, embark on massive soak-the-corporation policies, then you have to look at that stock market, look at these corporations making money, and realize that these are legitimate prices being paid for these equities.
Now, let me thank the caller. I've got another email here to read that's sort of on topic. Listener writes, if magical thinking is what they're still teaching in economics courses, as far as I know it is, and what they are teaching in economics courses is the basis for accepted truth, it is, then of course the economy is recovering and the big banks are innocent of all serious crimes and life in America has never been better. But as with all things, if the premise is wrong, then what follows from it will likely be too. And the premise that magical neoclassical thinking can describe our economic system accurately is wrong for several reasons, not least of which being that they don't figure private debt into their models. And hear from you on that, Peter Coy?
That's a really broad indictment. I would like to take one little piece of it, which is both Jerry and Chris were talking about how the excess reserves in the banking system are evidence of failure of the Fed policy. But Ben Bernanke has always said that trying to increase bank reserves was never the intent of the quantitative easing, the so-called asset purchases. It was more of a side effect. The intent was by coming in there and being an additional buyer of long-term securities, which is both treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities, the Fed would help push down the interest rates on those, which in turn would make borrowing cheaper for both corporations and households. For example, it would help keep down mortgage rates and make it easier for people to buy houses and get the housing market going again. So to that degree, it has worked. The fact that banks have a lot of excess reserves is something that will have to be mopped up later, and the Fed has plans for that, such as paying interest on excess reserves so banks are more willing to hold them. But I think it's important to note that the excess reserves themselves are not evidence of a failure of the Fed policy.
Yeah, Peter Coy is economics editor with Bloomberg Businessweek. Here's a comment from Ethan on Facebook who writes, it's the same old story, recovery for the 1%. Meanwhile, the working class continues to lose ground. GDP is up while median income is down 5% since the beginning of the recession. Somehow, I don't think the cost of living dropped 5% to compensate for this loss. People are hurting big time. Let me bring another caller on here, and that's Harry from the city. Hi.
Hi, yes, good morning. First of all, I wanted to point out that these inflation figures are rather rigged because they don't include things like the price of gas, which has really hit people, the ridiculous rise in tolls, a lot of more sort of neoliberal entrance fees and things like that, and also the rising cost of food, which has really skyrocketed and is really hurting a lot of people. And also, I wanted to say that it would be great if you have this discussion again, if you bring someone like Richard Wolff in. And I also wanted to ask your guests to comment on the long-term effects of low interest rates on pension funds that need to raise money and are having a hard time because unless the stocks appreciate, you're not getting it through your traditional investments, and also on retirees because those people are strapped. They're not making their money back. If you're getting 1% as opposed to 6%, it's $10,000 on $1 million in savings a year. So effectively, those retirees are also spending money locally. Also, the sequestering is also going to cut back on, say, these people not getting these food stamps means that they're also not able to spend money on the groceries. If you look at poorer people, all of the money that they receive in so-called entitlements actually goes back into the local economy.
Harry, let me take your you got a couple points there, and I want to go first to Jerry Nicholsberg on the idea that the inflation figures are rigged or they're not really real inflation figures.
Okay, so there are various measures of inflation, and you know we often look at the CPI. Sometimes we look at the CPI without energy and food. That's the core inflation. That one seems a little strange to me since we all buy energy and food. But the inflation rate is in fact fairly low, and we talk about high gas prices. Inflation is the rate of increase in prices, and our gas prices have been high for some time. The recession in Europe and the slowing of the Chinese economy has kept world petroleum prices from really increasing, and so I think the inflation numbers, you know, what you want to look at is really how are they changing, and they're not changing much. They're staying fairly low, but But I did want to comment on this notion of quantitative easing and whether or not it's working, because I think that, you know, the presence of non-borrowed reserves or excess reserves is not an indication of whether it's working or not. What the Federal Reserve said in their testimony to Congress was that the purpose of this was to basically make bonds less attractive and force money, investment money that was looking for yield, into homes and into the stock market in order to boost consumption through.
And by the way, excuse me, Professor Nichols, but bond prices actually fell after the chairman's speech, too.
Right, but I mean, there's a lot of volatility, and you can't take these near-term numbers very seriously. But the purpose was really to boost consumption. I think the evidence that it's not working is that we've got subpar economic growth. Consumption is not growing faster than income. It's growing slower than income, or about at the same as income, depending on which quarter you look at. And if you look back at history, you see no times when quantitative easing or pumping up the money supply has really made a big difference in a long, slow recovery, not in the 1870s, not in the 1890s, not in Japan and in the 1990s. But the reason why I think Chris, and I hesitate to speak for Chris, but why I think this excess reserves is a big issue because I'm not nearly as sanguine as Peter that the Federal Reserve can really pull it off to get those excess reserves out of the system before it causes a real inflation.
Let me go to Peter Coy on this, because actually the caller also raised a question about low interest rates and their effect on pensions and retirements. And Peter Coy, I'd like you to address that if you could.
Well, yeah, that is a serious problem. And it's one of these cases where, as people have pointed out, low interest rates are a blunt instrument. They create winners and losers. The losers are people on fixed income. And Ben Bernanke has addressed this several times because he knows he's got a lot of people out there who are not happy about what they see as punishment of savers. His line is that, look, in the long run, it's in everyone's interest to have a growing economy. And if that requires keeping rates extremely low for some period of time until the economy catches fire, then it's a big price to pay, but ultimately worthwhile.
Let me get another caller on here. I want to bring in Cass, who's joining us this morning. Cass, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I just have a couple of observations, if I could add them. I've been hearing, and what I can gather is that there's an agreement about the fact that money is just being held onto and not lent out, or companies are just holding onto money, right? So the thing is that I want to take up where Chris was talking about, because he took the words right out of my mouth, but he didn't then go on and say what you should do about it, which is that the current policy is not a bug, but a feature to get higher inflationary expectations. If the aim is to get people to get rid of their excess money balances, then one way to do it is to raise inflationary expectations, because then holding money now has a cost. And if you can't hold it without cost, then you're going to spend it. And that, I think, is a very important part of this. I also agree, though, unfortunately, that the current policy isn't likely to help very much, because we're in a liquidity trap. And since we're in a liquidity trap, the only thing that's really going to help us at the moment is to actually spend money in fiscal policies, such as infrastructure and all that other good stuff. And since we don't have a functional government at the moment that can allow what seems pretty clear and obvious to do to be done, I guess I'm going to say I'm pessimistic. But I understand what Bernanke's doing, but I just think that it's a pretty blunt instrument. So I agree with that.
Well, I thank you for your comments. Christopher Thornburg?
A couple of things. More or less I agree with that, especially the last part. You know, had they used all this federal debt they've been racking up to build infrastructure as opposed to giving folks tax cuts, it would have had a lot more stimulative impact on the U.S. economy, largely because the tax cuts more or less translated into more demand for imports. In short, our fiscal policy has been wrapped around the idea of borrowing billions of dollars from the Chinese to stimulate the Chinese economy, and I never approved of that. But I want to back up just a second, because a couple of things I think we need to point out. First of all, you know, we had a conversation about what low rates mean for savers, for the retired, things like that. And I agree, it is painful. But at the same time, again, low rates today are not because of Ben Bernanke's policies. Ultimately, interest rates are determined by the supply and demand for capital in our economy today. We have a weak developed world. And on top of that, we have a world awash with capital because the Asian economies are growing and they like to save. And throw into that the fact that information technology has substantially pushed down the cost of business investment, and you have a situation in which rates are low and they're going to remain low, and people have to just build that into their mindset. Unless we have another inflationary surge, rates aren't going up that much. They may be a little volatile because of Fed policy. They may come up a little bit as fear goes away, but ultimately low interest rates are here for us, are here to stay, and we got to keep that in mind. The last thing is, as far as consumers and consumer spending goes, consumer spending right now, 70% of GDP, it's never been higher. And oh, by the way, consumer spending is going up faster than incomes, because remember, we had a very large tax increase at the beginning of the year, and yet not only did consumer spending not fall, but it actually been growing despite those higher taxes. From a long-term standpoint, we're still a nation that overconsumes, doesn't underconsume, and that's a long-term problem we need to deal with. And when I say consumption, I'm talking about personal consumption. I'm not sure if Jerry was talking about total consumption, including business spending, which is a different issue.
So what do you think, and I'll ask this to all of our panelists this morning, the average person should do with their assets in terms of best positioning themselves to the near and long-term future? I'm getting a lot of questions along those lines. Hear first from you, Peter Coy.
Definitely not my area. I'm one of the buy and hold type, conservative. The last thing you want to be doing right now is placing timing bets on the markets. For example, saying I'm going to jump on this rally or I'm going to sell on this downturn. That never works out. Even the pros get that wrong, and amateurs are just really rolling the dice when they try that kind of thing and possibly endangering their retirement.
Well, maybe an ancillary question is what can best be done in terms of policy at this point from your perspective, Peter Coy? I mean, to bolster the economy and to sustain the economy.
Well, I agree with the person who said, lost track who it was now, that fiscal policy has to be, I think it was one of the callers, has to be part of the solution. Bernanke himself has kept saying that. He said, you know, there's only so much we here at the Fed can do. Congress needs to step it up. And lately, fiscal policy has been restrictive. We had the tax increases taking effect January 1st, and then we have the sequester, which is in effect now. The last thing we need with unemployment so high is for to take a big chunk out of demand through lower government spending. Clearly, in the long term, it's essential for the government to balance its budget, but this doesn't seem to be the ideal time for that kind of fiscal restraint.
So government fixed policy is restraining economic growth, Jerry Nicholsberg?
It is certainly not helping. The increase in taxes that we saw, while maybe necessary over the long run, because, you know, we do need to get our fiscal house in order, and the sequestration, a pullback in the government purchases of goods and services, those require an adjustment in the economy, and that's certainly holding back growth. And I think we, you know, really have to keep in mind that we have subpar growth now. It is increasing to average growth rates, but that's only average, and we need above average. And issues such as the deficit, and in particular the debt as it is compared to GDP, are long-term issues. Making decisions today about what should be the government spending 10 years from now, particularly since it'll be a different Congress and a different president, and they can change whatever seems to be really short-sighted, that the fiscal policy ought to be oriented around how can you responsibly help the economy grow in a healthy way.
And excuse me, it'll probably likely be a new chairman of the Federal Reserve as well.
All the indications are that that we'll have a new chairman of the Federal Reserve. And, you know, so looking out in this very long term does not seem to be wise policy. Now, having said that, this recovery is pretty solid right now. We have been underbuilding housing. The housing market is not overheated. It's growing in a pretty measured way. We underpurchased cars, and our cars are wearing out, and so the automobile industry is growing in a very measured way. Even though our trading partners are in recession or experiencing slow growth this year, they'll be coming out of that in the coming quarters, and that will give further impetus to economic growth. So on the one hand, we have subpar to par growth. On the other, it's pretty solid. And so coming back to your question, you know, what should people do with their money? I would say look carefully to companies that are growing with good products in a solid, financially responsible way.
Let me go to Chris Thornburg and get your take on this, Chris. But before you talk about either policy or what individual investors ought to be prudently thinking about, I'm looking at an email from a listener who says the dollar is gaining in strength, especially against Asian currencies. Will this trend continue?
No. We're still running a massive trade deficit, and I have to assume that the way that will equilibrate is for the dollar to ultimately continue to weaken. Although, you know, obviously, whenever there's any kind of market volatility, which is what we're dealing with right now, people immediately turn to the U.S. as a financial safe haven, which does tend to push the dollar up. And candidly, for the worse, as Japan has been dealing with over the course of the last couple of years. So, but my feeling is ultimately dollar, once things start calming down again, the dollar start going back down again. Last couple things also, and, you know, all this talk of trends, I think it would behoove everybody in the U.S. to take a step back, stop obsessing on where GDP was in 2006, and appreciate that even with a lack of a full recovery, the United States still offers, by far and away, one of the best standard of livings in the world, access to all sorts of wonderful things. And every day we ought to give blessing for living here because, again, what we have access to, and that's everybody. I mean, even those in the bottom 99% of the population have access to all sorts of wonderful things. And we're so, again, obsessed with somehow or other keeping up with the Joneses when really what we all have is pretty damn wonderful. And we need to appreciate that. Lastly, in terms of investments, I'm also going to take the same dodge everybody else did. I don't think any of us on this call are comfortable making investment decisions. However, I would state a couple things. A, as noted, interest rates are going to remain low, maybe not as low as today, but low, and people have to start spending less and saving more for the retirements. We need at the national level to deal with long-term issues with entitlements and the lack of savings to prepare for the future, which could be very dismal if we don't start doing that now. In terms of the markets, expect a lot of volatility over the course of the next year. Unwinding monetary policy is going to be ugly. It's going to cause stuff to bounce all over the place. People should be aware of that. And if I had one bit of investment advice for everybody, I'm going to agree with Jerry. Not only is the housing market not overheated, but I would argue that prices are still pretty good. If I were as everybody out there, and if you don't own a home, go out and buy one. Take advantage of these ultra-low mortgage rates. Because that's probably the best place to put your money now. As for everybody else, for the money, your financial assets, buy and hold, close your eyes, and just ride out the roller coaster.
And we'll bring another caller into the conversation here. David, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, I'll try to get a quick one in here. If I remember right, the Fed was seen as a criminal operation in the subprime, and it would seem to me that part of the court orders for restitution were that it was to buy these bonds. So I'm just wondering, typically there are, 13 districts of the Fed, and if it's lifting it, is it only lifting it in one or two of those districts, or is it doing a blanket lifting where some of the districts are still very hard hit?
Peter Coy.
The Fed was not found to be a criminal operation. Not really sure what the caller was referring to. The Fed, the one thing that where it came up with a court system was when they were required to disclose to whom they had made emergency loans. And they made a lot of loans to a lot of big banks, which doesn't look particularly good if you don't like those banks, but certainly not a criminal operation.
Let me thank the caller. And actually, we're coming toward the end of the program. I want to get a final word in, perhaps. I'm afraid maybe we may not have a final word here. We're up against the time, and it's a hard break, of course, as we come up on the NPR News. Let me just extend my thanks to all of those of you who joined us this morning in conversation, and particularly to our panelists, Jerry Nicholsberg from UCLA and Peter Coy from Bloomberg Business Week and Christopher Thornburg from Beacon Economics. Appreciate and grateful to you gentlemen for being with us. And you can also continue this conversation on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Remind you that we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening, and that we're going to be joined in the hour up ahead by Michael Levy of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the subject will be energy. And we'll get into, lots of production going on in terms of natural gas and what it all means as we move into a kind of different sphere, a different revolution where energy is concerned. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Today, however, it's Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our interns are Keelan Cronin, Kelsey Dayton, Maddie Pelton, Jonathan Tam, and Evelyn Wang. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez, our senior editor, Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.